Open Talk program. My name is David Inge. Good morning to you. Welcome back to the second part of the show. The producers for our program, Jack Brighton, Harriet Williamson, Brian Wagner is at the controls. We are going to continue with the kind of conversation we've been trying to have here over the last couple of days with different kinds of people talking about the events of Tuesday and how we can understand them or what they mean for this country. We have a guest. We're pleased to have this guest here in the studio. We're planning all along to have him here during this hour, but we were going to be talking about something a little bit different. However, his academic background, his interests, and his perspectives, I think, fit very well into what we've been talking about. And because it's a perspective from someone from outside of the United States, I think it's also very useful to hear. We're speaking this morning with Dan Diener. He is one of Europe's leading historians. He's director of the Simon Dubnow Institute for Jewish History and Culture at the University of Leipzig. He also holds a professorship at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Beersheba in Israel, and he is spending some time here on the campus of the University of Illinois as a George A. Miller visiting professor. He has written on a number of subjects, including the conflict in the Middle East, the history of the Holocaust, world history, dealing particularly with the long-term effects of collective memories. He has also written about Jewish history and the history of anti-Semitism. I also would like to mention that he was scheduled to give a talk in the MillerCom series tonight on the U of I campus, and the talk has been canceled. So we're pleased to have him here to give you and folks here in the community an opportunity to hear from him and to have some discussion with him. As always, comments, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that would mean that if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and calls on us, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, Professor Diener, thank you very much for being here.
I appreciate it.
To start, I guess, as you suggest, and as I think it would be interesting, I would just like to hear what you think, your thoughts, reflections about what this all means, for us, for the rest of the world, particularly as your perspective is not of an American, but essentially from a European perspective.
Very much European perspective and very much from a European point of view. And I think that as an historian of European history in general and of the 20th century in particular, that what happened on Tuesday, first of all, personally, it shocked me. I'm still in trauma, as all others. But on the other hand, I started somehow to interpret it and to integrate that what I saw on the TV and what I felt into a wider historical perspective. And that what shocked me so much, that somehow that was my feeling, that the former self-understanding of America, of the United States, somehow came to an end. There are some very important icons for a European, for instance, to see Manhattan in smoke from the seaside. And it's something like to turn history upside down. Coming from Europe, coming by sea, Manhattan, America is something like the heaven of safety, and suddenly it was turned around. Or to see and to understand the World Trade Center as something like the prolongation and modernization of the symbolic meaning of the Statue of Liberty, that this what hit. That are the icons which came up to my mind and were highly connected to an historical understanding of what America means from a European perspective, that America is something like, well, the other world, the new world in a different sense. There is a world and there is America. And America was somehow, well, defended and surrounded by two oceans. It was a feeling of a civil society without a state, as the German philosopher Hegel once put it, something completely safe, and this was hit. And I think that it's something which has to be somehow internalized. It will take a long time to understand this very meaning, what just happened.
Mm. Well, America has gone through a lot of conflict in the last century, and yet two world wars, and yet the mainland of this country wasn't touched. I don't want anybody to think I'm in any way minimizing the effects on this country of the wars and those people who fought and died in them. But it's still the case that it was people here experienced it at some remove. Nothing like this has happened in the history of this country, but nothing like this has happened in the last century. And I'm sure that for some time people will be talking about it and thinking about it as an event that that changed this country, perhaps in ways that at this point we can't even think about. I wonder, though, how you think about that and how you think that it might change the way that people in this country think about this country and also its place in the world.
Yeah, I completely agree. The United States, America, was something for, let's say, for Europeans, and we have to consider the reality that this country is somehow composed from people who left the former countries, their native countries, coming mostly but not only from Europe, just to get rid of from the problems of the old world. Peoples were immigrants, peoples were refugees. America was something which seems to be out of the realm of history as the Europeans understood it. Mm-hmm. And these pictures rose again during the early 90s when Yugoslavia was broken up and ethnic strife and warfare was seen on the TV. And suddenly, when I was reading American papers and mostly intellectual papers like the New York Review of Books, suddenly an American intellectual said, well, now I understand why our ancestors left Europe. That was Europe. Mm-hmm. Ethnic strife, nationalism, war. America was somehow outside the realm of what the Europeans understand by history. History was a capital H, not historical developments that you can tell about. That happens everywhere. But a notion of history. America was different. And my feeling is that what happened on Tuesday will change it a lot. And it has to do with, as far as I do believe, was a kind of, well, that's a negative side of globalization. And America was suddenly drawn into the world. And this coalition between the problems of the world and the existence and the self-understanding of America to be somehow outside the quarrels and the strifes which happened in Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, that will change the self-understanding of America. Freedom is not only a concept. Freedom is daily life. We will see what will happen in the United States when people will not be anymore in the position to use airplanes like buses, yeah, when people will be checked and so on. More state will be in the United States, more administration, more control. All these things which somehow belonged to the old world will be part of America and will change somehow, even I would go so far, the political philosophy of this country. And that is, I would say, the very meaning today, 2 or 3 days after that terrible event that happened in New York and in Washington, that will have its effect on the United States. It's something like, I would even say, a new form of foundational event for the United States. Mm. Foundational event as, let's put it like that, as a civil war or something different which somehow molded and restructured the self-understanding of America. It's not just a mere peripheral event. It hit something very, very crucial and very, very fundamental, what America means.
Yeah. I think it's really striking your comments about in the past, America and Americans somehow seeing themselves as being outside of history. I think one could have argued that may be one of our great failings, that in fact we have seen ourselves as being outside of history.
Well, the United States, the involvement of the United States in the First and even more in the Second World War was really crucial, but one had to consider that this involvement, more in the Second than the First World War, brought America into the world, and nobody thought in America in 1914 or in 1939 to get involved in conflicts which were of a European and an Asian dimension. I'm, again, as a Europeanist and not as an historian of American history, I still was always struck, for instance, by concepts and doctrines like the Monroe Doctrine of the early 19th century, when America declared, here we are and there is Europe and there's no connection between us. That's a different, completely different world. The First World War, well, America showed up on the European battlefield, but it was not really felt. And immediately in 1920, America removed its involvement. It was not anymore in Europe and left the European to be alone among themselves, and the horrible period of the 30s and later the Second World War were a result. And after 1945, the Americans wanted to pull out of Europe immediately. And what happened was, the emerging Cold War, which let the Europeans stay in Europe and made North America, the United States, a world power. But still, the very feeling of America was, we are involved. It's our, let's say, international responsibility, but we are not really part of it. We are not really part of it. We can pull out whenever we want. We can get in whenever we want. Now I have the feeling that it changed. The whole self-understanding of America is put somehow into question.
I would like to get to a caller here in just a moment and reintroduce our guest. We're speaking this morning with Dan Diener. He is one of Europe's leading historians. He's director of the Simon Dubnow Institute for Jewish History and Culture at the University of Leipzig. He's also holds a professorship at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Beersheba in Israel and is, at the moment, a George A. Miller visiting professor at the University of Illinois. Two other things I'd just like to mention real quickly, because I had talked about them earlier. It now appears that the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, will be holding his press conference at about noon. And when that happens, and if National Public Radio provides coverage, we'll bring that to you. Also, that we're expecting some kind of a statement from the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, at perhaps about 11:30. Of course, as these things go, one never knows exactly when they will take place. But again, if there's coverage there offered from National Public Radio, we'll bring that to you when it happens. So let's go ahead and bring in some people to the conversation here, starting with the caller in Champaign, and that'll be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I should apologize for my ignorance of this issue, but I wonder if you would be able to give me any background information or your thoughts on the sentiment of hatred of people against the United States in the Middle East. I don't really know much about it, why they would hate us. But perhaps you might be able to fill me in.
Well, it's a very interesting question, but I would, if you allow, somehow correct it in such a sense. It's not the Middle East, or it's not the people of the Middle East that hates America or hates the United States. I think it's something very deep going, even in Europe, also not comparable. There's some kind of, I put it like that, an ideology which can be called anti-Americanism, which is not directed against a specific state, but it's directed against a specific culture which has a lot to do with let's say, with universal form of capitalism, of modernity, something which changes tradition, which is everywhere, and somehow you find it as well in Europe, not as a political force, not at all, but a kind of sentiment. People dislike, or some people dislike America, not because of its policy, but because it is a different kind of civilization, which seems to be strange, foreign, to a more traditional societies. That is the background. Now, in the Middle East, well, we have to distinguish and to be very, very careful, and that's something the American administration has to consider, to distinguish, let's say, with its policy concerning the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, between Israel and the Arab states, and to try to resolve this conflict on the one hand. On the other hand, to be very much aware and conscious about, well, that there is no clash of civilizations, as others claimed. But America is seen as something which is, threatening forms of traditional way of life. People really don't understand the way of life America is representing. Even today, or mostly today, in the age of globalization, when people are coming much more closer, and that what happened 3 days, 2 days, 3 days ago is the negative result of globalization, a closeness of different cultures coming together, and then the difference is becoming much more obvious between these cultures. And in so far, America is seen as something like the pioneer of modernity and societies and cultures which are rejecting our civilization, which is a global civilization. They do pinpoint to America, and America seems to be something like a global enemy, but I wouldn't go so far and identify this sentiment and this understanding with the peoples of the Middle East, not at all.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to another caller here in Aurora on our line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I have a couple of things. What is the Caliban? I was going to call the library, but I heard your program, so I thought maybe you could explain. What is the Caliban?
Well, I'm not a specialist on the Taliban, on this group, but, and my knowledge is very general. It's a group of Muslim fundamentalists, which was established during the period of the resistance against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, mostly by the Pakistanis. They were they were born and raised. Now it's more than 20 years. They were all born or raised in the refugee camps of Pakistan, and which were supported. One has to remind the audience that the Taliban and the Pakistani government up today is supported by the United States, and they were fighting the Soviet Union in the last phase of the Cold War, and the Taliban conquered all of Afghanistan, and during the last years, and established a very, very fundamentalist Islamic regime, so much fundamentalist that it is even rejected by other Islamicist movements or even governments. For instance, the government of Iran in Tehran is at loggerheads with the Taliban government in Afghanistan. So we have to be very differentiated concerning that what's happening in the Middle East, even among Islamist fundamentalist or regimes or groups. There are a lot of differences. The Taliban is now the government of Afghanistan, a fundamentalist regime, and which was established in the struggle against Soviet occupation in the 80s.
What will happen when the countries have to choose sides? I can see that, you know, a country will have to decide if it, they are going to be for United States or not join in, or they're against the United States. I can't imagine how much problem and how much that will really tear countries apart.
I can hardly imagine that any country, if you are talking about states and countries, and not about fundamentalist groups, which are hardly to locate, that's our problem today, I don't see any state or any country standing up against the United States. And I don't believe, and I wouldn't like to see it, that the United States will act unilaterally. That means one-sided. I think it ought to be an international coalition, a world coalition, with the Europeans, with the Arab states, with Israel and with others, to deal with this problem. If I may, as an historian, somehow compare the present situation, also it differs completely from the past, but somehow when the Ottoman Empire, the large Muslim empire, which existed for more than 400 years and collapsed at the end of the First World War, that when this empire weakened, mostly at the very beginning, at the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century, there were a lot of pirates in the area of the Mediterranean, in the Persian Gulf, and so on and so far. And there was an international coalition and military involvement to fight these pirates. And there is some similarity, also the situation is completely different and we're living in another world, but to compare the international struggle against pirates with the international struggle today against this kind of terrorism. It should be international. It shouldn't be unilateral. It should involve Arab and Muslim states as well.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll continue. Our next caller is in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you for having me on again. I was cut off last hour, and I just thought that maybe this would be an opportunity to, you know, in a different context, to make some of the same points I was making them and perhaps then, and perhaps to follow up on them.
Sure.
What I'm hearing from Professor Diener is kind of a class of civilizations model of world history or of recent history, such as propagated by Samuel P. Huntington, Robert Kaplan, Thomas Friedman, and others who feel that the United States is offering a kind of you know, beneficent vision to the world, and that there are certain elements in the world that can't tolerate that and can't accept it, and that are threatened by that. I read history completely differently, I must say. What I see during the last century, and especially since the Cold War, or since World War II, and then the end of the Cold War, is that the United States would not allow third world nations, and especially in the Middle East, to develop their own particular forms of nationalist, democratic, or otherwise institutions, to come to terms with modernity in their own way, and that the evidence for this has to do with the overthrow of you know, indigenous nationalist forces in countries like Iran, Syria, Iraq, and so forth, the support for authoritarian governments, Afghanistan, one example, also in terms of their support for the Taliban, Vietnam, all of these countries which wanted, you know, not to idealize any of them, I must add Indonesia in there. None of them were allowed, in whatever ways that they may have deemed necessary in terms of their own people and their own nationalist ideologies, to deal with a post-colonialist modernity in a way that was apart from global politics, and especially apart from the United States' satisfaction, pursuance of its economic interests. I simply have to say that I see this attack not as a class of civilizations, but as the, and maybe in a different sense it is, but it's basically the chickens coming home to a roost, as Malcolm X would have said. I think that we have deemed the Middle East an extremely important reason because of oil. We have sacrificed incredible precious resources, human and otherwise, both of our in terms of our own people, but especially in terms of the people there. We have devalued human life. We have devalued the human life of what we see as faceless Arab and Muslim peoples. And I simply am opposed, in all honesty and in all due respect, to this view of the world. I don't think it gets us anywhere, and I certainly don't think it's any way to deal intelligently with what has happened this week.
Well, Professor Diener, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I think that I have to correct this impression that I'm not supporting the theory of Huntington concerning the clash of civilization. I think it's a very generalizing and it's not a theory which helps to really to understand. But on the other hand, I do believe that the command and the interpretation our last guest is not so far away from the Huntington's thesis. It's just turning it around. It means that there is some kind of international or even American conspiracy concerning the so-called third world states, which try to establish their own modernity. I would agree, for instance, concerning the intervention of the United States and more even Britain in Iran in 1953, when the Mossadegh government was toppled. And that was really what we understand in history or in political science as an imperialist plot and intervention into the domestic policy of another country. In the 60s, the 50s and 60s, things have to be seen and understood in the framework of the Cold War. But the Cold War came to an end in 1989 or 1990-91, and we are completely in a different world. And I think that it's less, or even not at all, the American policy that tries to ignore and to disrupt any indigenous democratic society. I think it is more a struggle between specific elements in this society against their own leadership, against their own, let's say, government, for instance, the struggle of the Egyptian government against Egyptian fundamentalists has nothing to do with the United States. Or even, I would say, when the former Syrian president Assad, the father of the present president, destroyed the power of a Muslim fundamentalist in 82 by putting to ashes nearly the Syrian city of Hama. It has nothing to do with the United States. It's a struggle inside the societies between specific groups and between specific ideologies. I don't ignore at all that the United States is the most important power in the world, and that the way of life, the American way of life, somehow is becoming globalized, and other people may feel endangered and provoked by this way of life.
But you trivialize this expression way of life by ignoring the actual economic consequences of American foreign policies. This is what this whole anti-globalization movement is all about. It isn't about Britney Spears like the man The Last Hour says. It's about fundamental economic consequences of U.S. foreign policies, which are not conspiratorial in nature and do not make me a conspiracy theorist, but which are very, very clearly laid out in data after document after evidence of what it is the United States really wants from these countries, what it wants and what it's afraid of. And it isn't that it's afraid of Islamic fundamentalist movements. We support the most Islamically fundamentalist country in the world, namely Saudi Arabia. It doesn't have anything to do with that at all. It has to do with being opposed to any country which might decide that it can dispose, it should be able to dispose of its own resources in the manner which it sees fit, regardless of U.S. interests.
I don't want to interrupt you, but only one point. I don't want to push into a corner where I'm suddenly defending American foreign policy. I'm not an American foreign policy spokesman. I try to understand what's going on. But just one correction. The Saudi government and the Saudi society is not a fundamentalist society. It's traditional Islam. It's not fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is not a traditional reaction. Fundamentalism is a reaction of Muslim modernity. Most of the people who are fundamentalist or fundamentalist ideologists were formerly very, very enlightened people. A lot of them were former communists. Others were educated in the West. It is a later backlash of their tradition coming up from the 70s and 80s, being disappointed by modernity. They were becoming fundamentalist. Saudi Arabian society or the Saudi leadership, I'm not very fond of, I have to claim, but they are traditionalists, they are not fundamentalists.
Well, I'll allow you to split that hair, except to say that whatever this backlash is, it's a backlash resulting from the failure of nationalist movements in these countries, a failure of which was engendered by United States foreign partly and probably mostly by U.S. foreign policy. And it hasn't really changed that much since the Cold War. It's just a new enemy. Now, instead of the Soviet Union being the enemy and everything that we do in the Middle East being justified in terms of the Cold War, now Islamic fundamentalism is the new enemy, and everything is done to justify opposition to that, except when, of course, we have to support some Islamic fundamentalists because, or whatever you want to call them, because they support our economic goals.
We just have about 15 minutes left. I have a couple of other callers, and I hope the caller will forgive me because we have, I think, given him quite a lot of time to make his comments. And I don't know if there's anything else that you want to say, or we could just go on and we talk with some other folks. And I do want to give other people a chance to make comments, ask questions too. Let's go on here. The next person is in Champaign, and it's line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I agree with the last caller in many ways. I think that before the Second World War, the United States had already assumed the colonial interests of Spain in this hemisphere and viewed the countries of this hemisphere as having to toe the line for our economic interests or pay the price. And at the end of the Second World War, when the colonial powers of France and Britain and others collapsed, we assumed their colonial aims, stabbing Ho Chi Minh in the back in Vietnam and thereby plunging our country into chaos for a very long time. And then Britain and France had very carefully constructed the countries that came out of their holdings in the Mideast and used them, the area, as a means to solve Europe's Jewish problem, and then used the way they constructed countries to control oil, which has been a driving force of foreign policy throughout this century. So I think the United States had some chickens come home to roost, and they're going to keep coming unless we stop raping the rest of the world of its resources.
Well, Professor Diener, any comments you want to make?
Again, and I'm not an adherent of conspiracy theories, and I, from a European perspective, I have to world claimed that it was the United States, and also the policy of Roosevelt during the Second World War and later on, immediately afterwards, after his death, that it was the United States that, well, because of a policy which is based on free trade, and others would claim that it's imperialism. Okay, we can talk about it, what it means. That the Dutch and the French and the British colonial empires were somehow were taken apart by American policy. I just, as an historian, have to put my finger on the quarrel between Churchill and between Roosevelt after concerning the interpretation of the Atlantic Charter about self-government. American government was in favor of self-government, and it means some kind of, let's say, anti-colonial policy. Anti-colonial in the sense of an immediate presence of the French, the British, and the Dutch in their colonies. And it's true, I would agree, that the Americans stepped in into the tradition of the colonial empires, but as McNamara said it concerning the war in Vietnam, it was a mistake, a big mistake. It doesn't mean that it was somehow a necessity of American existence and American policies to step in Indochina and to fight this it is unreasonable and morally not acceptable war, the war in Vietnam. But one has to distinguish between, let's say, America is not something like a nation state like we know them in Europe or maybe in the European periphery or other, let's say, political bodies based on some kind of belonging. America is, it's a universal system, if you like it or not. And insofar, America is somehow everywhere. And by judging the United States, its very existence according the concept, the notions, the lines of European nation states, means not really to understand modernity. And insofar, I'm very much in favor, personally, of complete self-government, of national self-determination of the different countries. But on the other hand, one has to take into consideration what does it mean in an age of globalization. We have to find the right institution. Insofar, I'm a criticist of globalization, but I cannot be against the weather. I cannot be against the wind. I cannot be against the clouds. Globalization exists. It's not just an invention. It is there. It is very much connected to specific kinds of technology and so on and so far. Insofar, it has to be regulated. True, it has to be regulated, but can only be regulated internationally in the framework of international organizations. And not according the perception of the national state in the European periphery or in Asia, as in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, where people did believe they have just to establish national states according to the French model of the French Revolution, and that was that were the high days of anti-imperialism, with people like Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, of Tito in Yugoslavia, of Sukarno in Indonesia, and so on and so forth. And one has to remind our listeners that Ho Chi Minh, when he declared the independence of Vietnam, of North Vietnam, Democratic Republic of Vietnam, he cited the American Declaration of Independence. That was that was the document of independence, of liberties, and of anti-colonialism. It sounds today very, I would say, somehow crude or even unbelievable, but the peoples of the third world in the struggle against colonialism, which meant the struggle against Britain, France, and the Dutch in Asia, and in other parts of the world, that the Americans were somehow a model, and the Americans didn't step into this role because mostly, I do believe, out of naivete or another kind of understanding, they stepped into the Cold War and took over the tradition of the former colonial powers. But it came to an end, and I think that the discourse today is a different one, and we cannot just prolong this understanding of imperialism and imperial expansion and economic involvement as it was done, let's say, 30, 40 or 50 years ago. We are not anymore living in the days of Sukarno, of Nasser, of Tito and all the others, and of Fidel Castro, if you like. It's a different world, and we need, I fully agree, we need institution in order to regulate our world, which is today globalized. Regulate means to democratize them. Regulate means more state intervention. Regulate means some kind of international supervision connected to United Nations or other institutions of international holding.
We have just about 7 or 8 minutes left, and perhaps I should introduce again our guest for anyone who's been tuned in the last little bit. We're speaking with Dan Diener. He is one of Europe's leading historians. He's director of the Simon Dubnow Institute for Jewish History and Culture at the University of Leipzig, and also holds a professorship at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Beersheba in Israel, and he's now spending some time on the campus of the University of Illinois as a George A. Miller visiting professor. He was scheduled, by the way, to give a talk in the MillerCom series tonight talking about the understanding the 20th century, and that has been canceled, so that won't take place tonight. And we have some other folks here, and again, I want to go on trying to get in at least one or two others. I think that next caller should be in Champaign, I think, on line one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
David, I'm glad you've had some cogent callers today, because I'm afraid your guest's account has been generally propagandistic. For example, it's simple Israeli propaganda to draw a distinction between Islamic fundamentalism and Saudi traditionalism. And the reason that's done is, of course, that Saudi Arabia is an effective ally of Israel right now, since both countries are clients of the United States. And for that reason, in the context of, the burgeoning worldwide war against fundamentalism, Saudi Arabia has to be removed from that category. This is a distinction without a difference. This is made up for the purposes, as I say, of propaganda. It's not new. It was, after all, the Israeli secret police who established Hamas, religious organization designed to undercut secular nationalism amongst the Palestinians. So to do the sort of accurate history that your callers have been suggesting is absolutely appropriate here, and needs to be done over against what are essentially propagandistic assertions.
Professor Dan?
Well, if it's propaganda, so I don't have to add anything about it. So.
Well, then we'll go again to Urbana here, line number three. Hello?
Yes. This may seem a simplistic question. I was just wondering whether or not the fact that some of the cultures that are clashing in modern-day global worlds have something to do with misunderstanding.
Pardon me, man. I have to interrupt you. I'm so very sorry to do that. However, we've got to go to National Public Radio for a statement from the Attorney General, John Ashcroft. We'll do that now.